and then we will have a conversation for about another 15 minutes, and then we will take live Q&A from the audience. I can say from great personal experience that Luciano is a really excellent person to listen to and to learn from, and to just be around. So I'm hoping that it's going to be a really fun evening. So for now, I'm going to disappear and hand over to Luciano, and see you soon.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. And with that introduction, now the pressure is on me. I'll make sure that this PowerPoint will be visible to everybody in just a moment. Bear with me. And while I do this, I hope that you will probably know that what we need to do here is to, well, look at this app business, which of course is a major issue these days, but try to look, if you like, philosophically to this particular episode in our life more broadly. So it's not just about the app, but it's also about who decides what in our lives, and how are we coping with extraordinary events like this pandemic. So in line of having a short introduction, and philosophers are not very good at short introductions, so I hope you will forgive me if my short will be a bit long for some of you. The attempt will be to give a broad overview of some of the ethical issues, and then some discussion of where I think some pressure is more significant. You may expect a lot about privacy, but it's not just about privacy. Now, the hope is that you are able to see what I can see, and therefore that there is a slide in front of you, which quickly summarizes the overview about these apps. We know that the apps have been developed in order to phase one, reduce the number of infected cases, the so-called flatten the curve. And of course, for phase two and the lockdown, return to some kind of normality, and hopefully not the same normality we had before, because we didn't like it that much, if you remember, but perhaps a better normality. Now, this mobile software application are quite straightforward. They use Bluetooth, as we heard a million times, BBC and so forth. You can see here a slide which illustrates very simply the sort of interaction. Say you and I have an app in our mobile phone. We get quite close. Our Bluetooth has exchange signals. And then there is a mechanism, more in a moment, whereby if I get unfortunately sick, you might be alerted that you met me, say, a few days ago. Now, of course, all this in theory is wonderful, but in practice it gets a little bit complicated. The complication here is that we need to protect a lot of sensible data. Who the people involved are, where they are, who owns the information about what and for how long, and what is done by whom with this information. What you see here is one of the major debates. It's not the only one, and the acronyms don't help. But imagine essentially two good-willing, well-intended approaches to privacy and how to protect our data while we run all these apps in the background in every society. This, of course, is mostly here in Europe, but the one on the left, the pan-European, etc., and the one on the right, the decentralized, which actually generated from the one on the left, are the two major players these days around the world. Now, in this particular context, what's the difference? I'm going to oversimplify because I like to get straight to the ethical debate. So this simple slide illustrates two major philosophies, so to speak. One tells you that what we need is a centralized database. So all the signals, all the bits of information go from the mobiles to the centralized database, get some elaboration back to the mobile phones. The one on the right does most of the work, in fact, the whole work, roughly speaking, I'm generalizing and simplifying, on the phones. You only need something outside to ping the connection every now and then, so to speak. But there is no centralized database. Now, what's the difference here? Well, the one on the left, you can do much more. If you imagine build a database, you can do, for example, some epidemiological studies on the data you have collected. So it's good for science. It can be good to flatten the curve, maybe to approach the next wave or even the next pandemic. What's the cost? Well, trust and privacy, of course. Once you have a centralized database, well, the risks are higher and you need to trust people who are running the whole business. Now, in England, we have the NHS and therefore the trust is at a maximum level. In some other countries, that trust might be much, much lower. On the right, well, there is much less need for trust because there is no a database, so you don't have to exercise trust on anything. Of course, you also can do much less. You don't have the data, and therefore you can't mine the data for other purposes, good purposes. So how do we decide about this? Well, here I'm giving you a quick overview of the headaches that you immediately encounter once you start thinking, okay, what's better? One, the other, a bit of both, a third alternative. So I put on this simple slide, on the blue line, say five ways of assessing it, from what I care about is totally unimportant, all the way down to this feature is absolutely critical. Can't do without it. Say, okay, fine. But what exactly are we talking about? Well, we move from legally acceptable, well, better be in line with the law, all the way down, for example, with epidemiologically useful. Remember the database? Going through medically useful, technically reliable, socially preferable, and you can put that, you know, green bluish dot a bit more to the left, to the right. Now, this single trade-off pattern is for every person you ask. Everyone will have different sort of balances here. Now, imagine that you are doing this in a group of people. Maybe it's a board, maybe it's a government. It could be an advisory group. You've got a lot of disagreement between people who have different trade-offs, say different pattern of those more or less of what, and mind also different lists of what is important, what should be in that particular trade-off. And on top of that, also about the delivery, as you can see in this picture, which technical solution delivers the best trade-offs once, assuming you actually have an agreement on the trade-offs. You can tell that things get immediately a bit messy. So much so that, of course, countries have already disagreed and they are not on the same line. On this slide, I put you some obvious cases. We have been exposed to them in recent weeks. France, Germany, Italy, NHS England, and others started supporting centralized solutions, like the one I illustrated before. Then immediately afterwards, quickly, Apple, Google provided an API, and some countries moved. I mean, Italy and Germany moved to a decentralized solution, which is supported by Google and Apple API. Now, this is not trivial. It's quite clear that at this point, the introduction of an interface by two companies has changed government's policies. The irony here is that allegedly, the app in question, if it is supported by the API by Google and Apple, will be a little bit more privacy friendly. That was not the debate we used to have only a few months ago when, of course, the European community, for example, European Union, was so much concerned with Google, Apple, and many others about privacy. And there's something to be said maybe during the Q&A about the morphology of power and how power is changing. So once again, stepping back from the specific app and the debate we're having today, if we are looking at this from, say, a century, writing a history book by the next generation, will they judge this time as the moment when we decided, well, look, it's too late. No, health data and so on. We need to come to terms with who really is in power here. Well, this is one of the questions that we are discussing here. And just to make sure that you get how the subtle balance here is between who controls what, This was a presentation by Google and Apple to some European members of parliament. It's on YouTube. Anyone can watch it. So it's not just the professor from Oxford who has access to it. And I was actually checking something else. And then since the presentation by Google was followed by Apple, I kept watching it. And at some point, this slide pops up. Now, you don't have to read it, the whole thing. What I want to show you is the last line, which is this one. Google, Apple can disable the system on a regional basis when no longer needed. Pause for a moment and think about what happens to that coronavirus app that runs on that particular API. Who has the key of the house? Well, clearly not the people who run the app, but the people who run the API on which the app runs. Recently, I must say, a journalist wasn't quite clear on the difference between API and app. The terminology doesn't help. So I use a little bit of an analogy. Say, look, it's like the harbor and a ship. The ship gets to the harbor, and if there's an harbor, it can go somewhere. Otherwise, there is no way to get to the land. And if I close down the harbor, well, so be it. So let's be careful about exactly who controls what and for how long. So now the recent sort of position that I have supported is in this particular slide is a very pragmatic reasoning. The essential point is, this is the situation in which we are. We might not be happy about it, but we better be realistic about where we are. And therefore, maybe we need to come to terms with the fact that this API is useful. Why? Well, if you look at this big arrow on your screen and start from left, we need as much privacy, transparency, and robustness as possible in order to generate more trust. Why? Because we need these apps being downloaded by millions and millions, and did I say millions? Of people. We're talking about tens of millions of people using this app to make any difference. So anyone has his own percentage, but when we started this discussion many, many weeks ago, realism suggested 60% of the population, which in the UK, given the fact that 20% of the population does not have mobile phones, is 80% of the population. That is staggering. Now, below 20%, the app is entirely, totally useless. So between 20 and 60, that is where the app makes an increasingly good difference to our so fight, quote unquote, against the pandemic. So we need a lot of uptake. Lots of uptake, more effectiveness, less social injustice. This is one of the points I like to talk about in a moment. Just give me one more slide, so to speak. So notice that the control of technology by someone is not technology's control of someone. Who is exactly in charge here? In recent discussions, I think one piece that is missing is accountability. We would like to make sure that the right sort of entities, organizations, institutions, group of people are accountable for this massive sort of deployment of technology at a time where we need it, possibly to make our life a little bit better. So in a democracy, who controls whom? Now, this is a very old problem, and the Latin phrase there reminds you that no, we've been dealing this for a long while. But there is an easy answer, a bit of a trick, philosophically speaking. You know, you have someone out there, you want to control that someone. So you put someone in control. And the immediate answer to that question is no, there's a controller. The next question, who controls the controller? Well, in a democracy, is the person who is being controlled. That's the custodendi there in Latin. It has to be a full cycle. In a democracy, it's the people who appoint people who basically always have oversight on things that then go back in terms of accountability to the people themselves. If you don't close the cycle, then you're not living in a democracy, you're living in something else. Sometimes not a nasty place, but certainly of doubtful democratic profile. Now, this control is exercised in many ways. You can exploit market forces, maybe it's a competition. You can exploit the law. No, you make it legal, illegal, and that is how you take it, compliance and so on. Or you can exercise ethical judgment. Now, I put ethics at the bottom because I think informs all the other two. Is by having an ethical perspective on what is right and wrong, then you develop the right laws and you also exploit the market properly. The picture there is just enticing anyone who's interested in understanding how Jessica, myself, Josh Kals, and Maria Rosa Taddeo at the Digital Ethics Lab in Oxford have developed let's call it a test to check whether your app is or is not ethically justifiable. 16 questions that need to be answered properly. And as I said, with trade-offs. Let me give you a taste of the ethical assessment of these apps. The control of technology, by us, not the other way around. You need to do your verification, and I'm talking engineer terms, so apologies for the policymakers, the philosophers. These words have different meanings in different contexts, but here verification means, are we building the right thing? And validation, again, engineering. Whatever we're building, are we doing it in the right way? Now, with these two questions, you obviously have a clear answer since a long time ago. The verification means it has to be necessary, because if it is not, well, reconsider. We think that, now, given the tragedy of the coronavirus, an app might be necessary. It might provide extra help, so let's try it. It has to be proportionate. You can't ask too much to the population already under so much pressure and so much, quote unquote, in pain. So is it the right solution for the right time for the right people? It better be scientifically sound. You can't have just something there, see what happens, nor beta testing here, because we're talking about something really sensitive and temporary. This is quite simple. Remember who controls whom and who is accountable to whom. Well, if you want to, I'm oversimplifying, control me, I'm happy to be controlled if you tell me for how long. If you tell me, I don't know, maybe forever, maybe I am a little bit more skeptical. But you tell me, channel, need to make a sacrifice, everybody together for 6 months. I might be readier to download their app. A lot of the debate has been on privacy, of course. Is an app ethical, non-ethical, my data, where they go, who's using them, etc. But we pretty much know that the technology today is sufficiently developed to make sure that if you do the right thing, and that's a big if, but if you do, then privacy can be protected. I mean, even at the European level, the European data protection supervisor said, yeah, it can be done satisfactorily. So what's the problem? Well, the other problems, the efficacy of this thing and the social justice. I put there some data at the European level where 43% in 2017 of people in Europe didn't have the skills to use such technology. So we can't simply assume that as long as you have an app there and they trust me, they will download it. They might not be able to, they may not have the hardware, the software, the skills. It's called digital divide for a reason. And we've been dealing with the digital divide for decades. So we need to remember this is a big issue. And then social justice or lack of social justice. Anyone thinking, look, Luciano, we have a solution. We want people to download the app, therefore we make it attractive. How? Well, we provide some incentives. Like what? Well, if you have the app, you can go back to work, you can take public transport, you can socialize, you can go back to the pub, etc. You have a normal life. That's a big mistake. That's a horrible mistake. Because all of a sudden, if you remember the efficacy, you divided the population between those who can have a normal life, download the app, etc., and those who do not have the means, the abilities, the skills, the interest, or even the age to do this. Now, citizens of first class and second class, so that I have the right incentives, so that people download the app, totally bad idea. It is not being done at the moment, but I heard people talking, newspapers and so on, or why not attaching this to some convenient solutions? Not my advice, definitely. We're coming towards the end of my quick presentation, my 20 minutes. I want to end with a few risks and a few lessons learned from here. Maybe to prompt more Q&A and see what our community today can come up with. Here are just some major risks of all technological solutions, app included. So assume for a moment that privacy is not a problem. Just concede that for a moment. It might be, but just for the sake of argument, it might turn out to be only a political solution. Now, typical thing like of the politician who will tell you, well, we tried everything, you can't blame me for not trying. Remember, the validation is detached from, verification. It's just doing something that is in question, not whether it works. Not a good idea. It might be a big waste of time in terms of cost, literally money, but also in terms of distraction, opportunity cost. We've been doing this, we haven't been doing that. And while all the social, political capital, our attention, the news, etc., was focusing on this, meanwhile we were not sort of considering other solutions, perhaps more important. And the flop might actually undermine other future potential technological solutions. And since I tend to think that technology can be, if properly used, a great sort of solution and help for some of the problems we have today, environmental, social, it would be a disaster if we were to develop the wrong solution that for the following months or even years says, you know what, never, don't even try it again. In essence, first of all, technology is never ethically neutral. I still hear people say, well, you know, we'll just produce an app and then can cut both ways. Not true. But mind the distinction here. And it takes three steps. Step number one, a mistake. Technology is neutral. Can cut both ways. No, it isn't. It's always loaded. Step number two. Oh yes, of course, it's always loaded. It can do one thing or another. But step number three, it can be loaded in different ways. A trivial example. We call a knife both the little thing that you get, say, on an airplane to spread some butter, no, this short, no blade, etc., and a bayonet, which is meant to someone. So when I say that technology is not neutral but loaded, I mean loaded in a way that is also with a bias for good or for evil. And our technology, our digital technologies are loaded mildly for good. I mean, we could do something good with it. If we don't, it's because we are using them improperly, badly, maybe the wrong incentives and so on. Don't assume trust is a strategy. Trust is something you gain, it's not you start with. It's like asking someone, say, look, can we have a contract here? Yes, sure, and how? Oh, you just have to trust me. No, I'd rather have a contract first and then I trust you. So trust is not a strategy, it's the end of the process, it's not the beginning of the process. Public debates can undermine trust. Now, I come from a generation that was all in favor of public debates because we didn't have them. We thought they were wonderful because we never saw them. Now that we have them, they are rather disgusting. A public debate is not the thing that a philosopher was imagining when he was an undergraduate. Intelligent, well-informed people, polite, exchanging points of views. No, it's a rather nasty way of defending one view rather than another. And thanks to some ways of doing journalism, it's always on the one hand, on the other hand. It doesn't matter whether one is defending astrology and the other one is defending astronomy. Now, we have that plenty of that in the recent events, politically speaking, in the UK. But Europe is also a terrible arena where this is happening. And of course, with this is the same story. There's a phrase that is attributed to Bismarck. I don't think it's by Bismarck, which says that you don't want to know how we make sausages and laws. Well, the same applies to science. You don't want to know how science gets its results. It's a nasty, not human, often impolite way of getting to something that is of high value. Sometimes public debates are not good for trust. They just undermine people like me who don't know anything about epidemiology and say, I don't know, they say so, they don't say so, good, bad, I'm not gonna do anything about it. I mentioned the morphology of power. Who is in charge today and who will be increasingly in charge in the future? I think we need to talk about this because once we get out of this pandemic, we might want to revise the rules of the game. And finally, the challenge is not digital innovation, but the good governance of the digital. We knew this years ago. We're just realizing now that this is increasingly the case, and it will be even more so as we get out of this pandemic, possibly, thankfully, to an app that is properly designed. Thank you very much.
Hi, thanks Luciano, that was really super interesting, and I can tell from some of the questions and prompts that we've been asking both on the Q&A and also on Twitter that people have also been joining in the audience. So I wanted to start our conversation by asking you to sort of come back right to the beginning of your talk. You said you wanted to talk philosophically or think philosophically. And I know one of your concepts is the idea of philosophical questions being open questions. And I think very much, and towards your point at the end of this talk, you were saying that the public debate on this has become extremely polarized. For example, decentralized is good, centralized is bad. And I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more around some of the open questions and more of this concept of things being more good or less bad, but still not overarchingly, this is the winner and this is the loser of the type of situation.
Yes, thanks, Jess. I mean, that is one thing that I wish we could make it clear in our minds for good. I mean, there's a sense that sometimes, because these are technological artifacts and there's a scientific debate about this, that is the whole story. Look, show me the technology, have a scientific debate, solution found. Not true ever, especially today, because depending on the country, the values, the social impact, even, for example, the distribution of who has which technology when, you may have different solutions here. So the simple elementary, forgive me, really stupid example I can bring is ask someone to build your chair, or just right now do a search, Google search on chair, something you see. How many chairs are available out there? Styles, material, comfort. There is no chair, there are chairs. Now, it doesn't mean that it doesn't have to satisfy requirements and constraints, but that's an open question at some point. Okay, given the requirements and constraints, which chair do we want now? And there are thousands of different styles of chairs. Can you imagine about an app that is so invasive in terms of potentially, in terms of our lives, on which our lives depend? Now, this idea, therefore, of open questions is exactly what philosophy deals with. I mean, philosophy is the science that is, as well, specializes in open questions. Questions that you and I, and I stop here, could be perfectly informed, completely rational, and open-minded, and yet disagree without being morons. Now, this is what happens today. But that's why I did mention that the public debates can undermine trust, but they can also be, if properly run, and I wish they were, the fundamental element here to make something that is a policy available and accessible and acceptable to everybody. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not doing that because we have this pseudo-scientific view that science and technology solve everything. Not true.
Yeah, thank you. That's a very detailed answer. I'd like to pick up a little bit on that point around public debates undermining trust and this overarching concept, particularly because of what you were saying towards the end of the presentation about the problem not being the technology, but it being the governance of the digital. And I think we have, again, in some of the public debates, I have seen a lot of people push back and say, oh, this is not necessarily a privacy issue, or as long as somebody is following the law, then it's not an ethical issue. So and I had two questions following up from that concept. One is just this slight difference between what is the role of the law and what is the role of an ethical debate in this particular context. And secondly, we have spoken before and you've written before about this idea of the normative cascade and the role of the public acceptability shifting and that influencing ethics and this influencing the law. So how do you think the fact that the pandemic has shifted attitudes in quite considerable ways towards data use, either for the good or for the latter, how do you think we should be preparing for the sort of longer term implications of that effect?
Well, thanks. These are difficult questions, but I'll try to get away with a short and simple answer, but they would require much more. So the relationship between ethics and law, again, with a quick analogy, I might get away with. Imagine a sport like football. So the law is really the rules of the game. If you don't play according to the rules of the game, you are out. End of the story. It does not tell you how to win the game. That's another story. So otherwise, I would be the best tennis player in the world. I know the rules. So what gives you that extra, the not just according to the rules, not compliance with the law, but above that, what I call ethics, or what I define in other contexts, soft ethics. What is doable over and above the minimal requirement in terms of not the law? In this case, for example, an app that collects data with which you can do more in terms of epidemiological studies, well, should we or should we not have? Well, the one that doesn't allow you that and the one who does allow you that are entirely, not perfectly legal. So the decision happens above that threshold of rules of the game. And how do I win the game? Well, that is the debate we need to have, and that's the trade-offs. At some point, those trade-offs are determined by the goal, what you want to do this for. Again, there is no trade-off as, no, or a bit of balance, like in the kitchen. So a bit of this, bit of that. No, that's not cooking. That's messing around, as I do. But no, if you want to achieve a particular goal, fulfill a purpose, then you reverse back and say, okay, in order to get there, that's the society I want. That's the ethics, therefore, I would like to see happening. Of course, in terms of legal compliance, because the laws of my country are okay. Mind that in all this, I'm assuming the laws of my country are okay, because there are plenty of places out there where the laws are not okay, and ethics is not soft, has to be hard. In other words, it has to tell you, don't follow the law, change the law, and then we start the game. The rules of the game are wrong. Now, but that is for another day, not in the UK, not in Europe. Now, this is something we are bumping into, and I come to the final question you ask, these days, because has always been there, but now is urgent. It's a bit like how I do not go to the dentist. I mean, I know that I should go as a problem, but tomorrow, and finally, you really have to go because the pain is immense. The pandemic is the pain, is immense. And now we are tackling issues that we could have tackled with more time, with less pressure, and therefore with a wider, more inclusive debate years ago. It's a shame, but there is a silver lining. Let's not forget the pain. It's when you are in pain that you plan the days when you're not. The coming back is not planned when you're winning, it's when you're losing. So let's plan the coming back now that we are not winning.
Yeah, thank you. Again, that was really helpful. The idea there about ethics being used to provide some degree of foresight, I think, is something that's really important. And in your presentation, you talked about verification and validation. So are we doing the right thing, and is the right thing being designed in the right way? But I think there's probably also an evaluation aspect, and is it continuing to operate in the right way, or are we achieving the right outcomes? And so I was wondering what you think, what mechanisms we should be putting in place, or government should be putting in place, in order to monitor the continuing performance, and what they should do if and potentially when these things start to not go according to plan for any particular reason.
Yeah, this is, again, a fundamental point. This is where some of the keywords that we use normally in any discussion, even when I go to the pub with friends, or I used to go to the pub with friends, now these days, never, no, don't call me out. I'm staying home, like almost everyone else. Transparency and accountability. I mean, these are not magic words, but they synthesize in one word what you need to have. The transparency of the process. As I, for example, deploy a particular app, I need to have a cycle of checkings. Is it working? Is it okay? Can I improve it? Is it really going somewhere? Are people happy with it? Are they downloading it? Are they using it? and on and on and on and on and on. So someone has to do it external, so it has to be a bit independent, not as it were, you know, I control myself, so that's a bad idea. And the transparency of that, so that you build trust. People are say, like me say, okay, now I can see what they're doing. They're doing the right thing. I can see what they're doing. And the third leg of trust, not one, two, three, accountable. If something goes wrong, who am I going to call? Who is going to lose the job, allegedly? Well, we need to know that too. But as long as transparency and accountability are not there, you cannot build trust. Now, unfortunately, because we are rushing all this all over the place, there is a tendency to cut corners and think, oh, transparency, oh, I'll publish this document tomorrow. And accountable, I don't know, between the cracks, and say, not a good idea. Because without those foundations, then the whole building will collapse. So spending a little bit more time and energy building transparency and accountability gets to trust, gets to a successful app. You don't do that, the cost will come later.
Absolutely. And I think what you're sort of touching on towards the end of that there is this concept of context and a little bit towards your affordances and constraints and what may or may not influence people in order to download the app. And I know we've had a question in the chat that we definitely cannot answer directly. It asks how many people are likely to download the app. That's not something that you and I can answer unless we have a crystal ball. But it would be, I think, interesting for you to talk a little bit about context, both temporal and spatial and technical, that might influence those decisions and how, so just elaborate a little bit on that.
Well, we can tell what has happened in other contexts where the app has been deployed. In two countries, Singapore and Australia, has not been successful. In both cases, the administrations decided to go for centralized apps that also historically, I mean, the API was not available, but decided to go for the more centralized, which enables, as I said, epidemiological studies, but requires more trust. It's more demanding, the numbers have been way lower than the minimum required. So I think Singapore, but people can Google it easily, they reach at most, best scenario, 25%. Or it's always a bit doubtful, you know, who was in Singapore, who not, 25%, which is the bare minimum to make any difference whatsoever. Remember, 40% is where it starts working really. Below 20%, you may as well burn the money. No, it makes the same difference. In Australia, we're talking about the same thing. Initially, a couple of million people downloaded, news everywhere. You need to remember the numbers. I think in Australia, there are about 22 million. Again, Google will help us here. But if those are the numbers. I mean, 20%, that makes, to me, about 4.5 million people. Not there at all. So big flop, honestly, to be frank, which means that it just doesn't work. The trouble with this, for those who are listening here, is that it also generates a false sense of security. I have the app doesn't say anything. I'm okay. No, you're not. You just met 10 people who do not have the app. The app wasn't working. Bluetooth wasn't working. They couldn't bother. They had the mobile phone off. They forgot the mobile phone and they were not well. Not true that no news is good news in this case. So it is dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. And then this is my final question for me, and then I'm going to share the results of the poll with you, and then we'll move on to Q&A. So my final question is, what you were touching on a little bit there is this idea of a false sense of security and that having an individual level harm. I think potentially why some of the public conversation around the pandemic in general, data use within the pandemic in general, issues of misinformation, but it has become particularly acute in the context of the app, is that I think society has become very used to understanding ethical risks from a data perspective, from the perspective of an individual. So who has access to my data? Who's seen mine? What control do I have? Whereas this is operating at a group level. And this is why, things like the GDPR is designed to flex in times of national crisis. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about this concept of individual level harms versus group level harms and how that different level of analysis affects what we might talk about in terms of an ethical impact.
Yeah, I'm afraid that that is a point that has not been touched by the debate to the best of my understanding, and it's a crucial one. We have been building privacy legislation and concerns about precisely, you know, personal as in individual personal data. But there is such thing as group privacy. Mm-hmm. And let me just give you a very simple example. In a small village, you know, everybody knows whether that family, I don't need to know, you know, who in the family, but in their family, someone is sick. And I couldn't care less whether it's Luciano, his uncle, his father, his mother, this family. So I stay away from the whole family. So this problem, which we will encounter again and again, is pretty old. I mean, we discussed this in the past, it's been discussed now for some years. And it tells you immediately that even the distinction, oh, we're collecting only metadata, that's not good enough. Because if you collect all the metadata of some group of people who are, say, in that particular area of the city, well, I just don't care who Peter, John, Mary are, it's the whole group of city. Now, in the past, just to give you a brutal example, when data were collected, metadata only, by one of the major telephone companies in an African country, and I'm a bit vague on purpose, they put them available out there quite easily for scientific purposes. It was a good idea. They forgot that they had collected the data during civil war in that country. And the civil war was ethnic and religious. So all you need to know is whether, you know, all people are gathering in a mosque or not, because I'm happy to bomb the whole mosque, not Peter, John and Mary or whoever. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to bomb the whole church. I don't care, no, about the individual. I care about bombing the whole group. Now, luckily nothing happened, but the risk was so close. Now, is that level of not thinking philosophically? Mm-hmm. That is disturbing. And trust me, these days, to the best of my understanding, group privacy has not been discussed, not even remotely. That is something we should do.
Thank you. That was my feeling as well. So I'm glad I'm not alone. So I'll quickly just read out, whilst you were speaking, we were running a poll on some questions with the audience. And I'm just going to read out the answers and then get your reaction a little bit as to whether or not you're surprised. So the first question we asked was, do you think an app is necessary to contrast the pandemic? And the biggest answer, the most popular answer, is maybe yes. And that's got about a third of the votes, 33%. The second question we asked was about, would you prefer a centralized or decentralized solution for the app? The vast majority here, you've got 54%, have said I prefer decentralized. And then our third final question was about asking about purpose limitation. So do people feel comfortable with this idea of it being used for purposes beyond contact tracing? And here you've got the most popular answer saying no, unless the purposes were specified in advance, and then I may reconsider. So according to our audience, people think that the apps or these types of apps, we're obviously not talking about any specific app, may be necessary. They would prefer it to be decentralized, and they are uncomfortable with the idea of it being used for purposes beyond contact tracing unless it is pre-declared that that's the case. So does that answer surprise you?
Unfortunately not. As you can tell, the questions were shaped what I hope is the most non-biased way. And we tried to provide as many possible different answers to make sure that we were not capturing people into a yes, no, sort of simple-minded pool, which you normally find people asking when they want a particular answer. So imagine that we had asked only, would you like to download the app, yes or no? I mean, who's going to say no? Yeah, maybe, possibly. So either you get no answer or you get a lot of yes. You can go back home and say, lots of people will download the app. Now you look at something a little bit more granular and say, well, depends. Is it centralized or decentralized? What purpose? Is it open or I don't know? Is it going to be used for something else? Now, remember what we said at the beginning, and to me is that the logic is quite straightforward. Uptake. Mm. Without uptake, we are wasting our time. So uptake as high as possible. How you get that? Loss of trust. How do you get lots of trust? With those answers. Mm. Decentralized, super specific, and let me know if you use it for something else, because I might change my mind. So that is how you build trust, which then you build uptake. And so, and then we might have a chance of doing better than Australia or Singapore. The other thing we need to remember is that despite what politicians have been saying around, and that is really rhetoric, this is a small component of a big strategy. The big strategy is medical and social. This is a tiny little thing, an extra. And if we don't do it, like Belgium, for example, which decided not to do it after all this pro and contra, yes, no, this kind, that kind, is that, you know what? We're not going to do it. Goodbye. Maybe that should also be considered if this is all messy. And remember, the costs are getting too high. Not so, not only financial, but in terms of mental attention, doing only that.
Perfect. Thank you. So I'm going to stop asking you questions now so you can breathe a sigh of relief. I'm going to ask you the infinitely more complicated questions that have been asked by the audience. We have quite a few questions. I'm going to try and get through as many as possible. If we don't get through them all, I do apologize. I'm also not going to read people's names out because we haven't asked whether you're happy for your name to be recorded. So I'm just going to read the question, but hopefully you will know that I'm reading your question. So the first question we have on a list is, this person is saying, I agree entirely with the issue about shift of power. I'm curious, what are the political philosophical ramifications, given that companies like Apple and Google have such enormous power and they have made decisions affecting our lives significantly? Should there be a different, more democratic governance structure within Apple and Google, i.e. in the sense of democratizing firms?
Well, I think that democratizing firms seems to be a little bit of too much utopian, even for a philosopher. I believe more in concrete measures, which to me are a combination of legislation, competition, public pressure, and then self-regulation. So law, you make them behave in a certain way rather than another, because this financial incentive or disincentive to do this. So the law needs to change. Then you can put some real competition between them for other things. Imagine that we have had more competition in terms of mobile phones. We have only two systems, basically. Anything else is negligible. That's not a good way. That's a duopoly that now can decide, once they're together, whatever they want to do. Social pressure. I mean, I might not be able to, and maybe the population could do something. So these three things definitely make some difference. A bit of self-regulation would not do any harm. People on this chat may know that I've been interacting a lot with these companies, especially with Google. And self-regulation certainly is one of the weapons we should use, but it's not the only one, and it's not the most powerful.
Thank you. So there's next question. I think touches on some of the points that you did bring up in the talk, and also some of the things that we were discussing about sort of social inequality, but perhaps we stayed quite high level in that discussion. So the person asks, I would like to question the assertion that technology is biased slightly towards the good. So good for whom? There is a socio-technical issue here. Apologies for mumbling your words. Considering the entanglement of the rise of techno-science against the long history of colonial modernity, generative of global racial capitalism. I think we were staying quite high level, but there's obviously more complicated issues of social inequality here.
True. And when I say they are slightly, should we say, biased towards perhaps more good than evil, I'm referring to the fact that that question can be asked on Zoom, literally. That's what I'm talking about. We can have this conversation, we can do this, that's the way of using the technology. I'm not blind, I'm too old and I've seen too much around to the obvious disasters that technology has caused all around us, obviously. But to think that digital technologies are large, basically, anything that runs on some computational devices is intrinsically evil, well, that seems to be insane. So it's neutral. It's not even neutral. It has the potentiality of being used for good more than evil. And that depends on the humans, but I would say yes. Now, if we were a little bit less stupid and a little bit more foresighted in our views, we could do an enormous amount of good with this stuff. It's just that we are not. Therefore, concluding, it's an evil technology is bias for evil. Now, we were so much better before internet, the web, IoT, you know, computer. Honestly, I don't think so. Now, imagine the pandemic without the internet, what that would have been. So if we are coping a little bit better with the world, it's also because of digital technology. Can they use not in the wrong way? Absolutely. Do they have a good chance and a better chance to be used properly and not decently? I think so. It's up to us though.
Yeah, absolutely. So this next question says, hi, thank you very much for the talk. Thank you for listening. The European Commission and European Parliament have advocated for decentralized contact tracing apps, but EU countries remain very divided over this issue. Do you think EU institutions have managed to successfully coordinate an EU-wide response? Is a stronger Europe necessary to counter the power of Google and Apple?
Yeah, so the response from Europe has been not as good as it should have been. There's too much fragmentation. At the same time, we need to remember that the European Union is not the United States of Europe. I mean, we forget how much, this is a union of national states, of sovereignties that are completely, utterly independent, for example, in terms of health measures. So you can talk to them, you can put them together, you can try, etc. But at the end of the day, it becomes a matter of national policy. And that is not touched by whatever recommendations, no matter how good. So the fact that we're trying to get a coordination at the European level is very welcome. I hope it will come as soon as possible, possibly yesterday. Are we going to see it? Well, we didn't even agree in this Europe on socks and sockets and stuff. So there are things that we even don't drive on the same side of the road. So there might be room for improvement, but I'm afraid that we're probably going to see a lot of apps that may not be compatible with each other, which is a big, big loss.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we are unfortunately running out of time. I'm trying to scroll through these questions. A lot of them are about, is this type of data or that type of data complicate the ethical issues, which I don't think we have time to go into the specifics of each general type of data. Also, one person has corrected our numbers on the Australian scenario. So thank you for that.
I'd be happy to reply to that one. So the correction was 5 million have downloaded, yeah. The population is 2.2. As I said, you need to have at least 20% to start making a difference. Success is 60%. So thank you for the correction, and just check what 60% or 22 million looks like.
And then the question I am going to ask is as our last question, because I think it picks up on many of the themes that we have discussed, is this one. When we say private versus public power must be balanced, who protects the public from governments? Who is the public power?
So here, I might indulge in a little bit of utopian thinking, if people don't mind. I think that the public in general we the people, so to speak, to quote the usual American constitution, we're really a bit sort of taken between a stone and a hard place. I think that that's the English expression, not similar to many other languages, which is the public and the private. Would you trust a state with all your data? In Europe, with the history we have had? No, remember? No, I'm not so sure. Would you trust multinational companies with your data? Cambridge Analytica, anyone? I'm not so sure either. So what do you do? Well, try to make them work one in balance of the other. The state protects you against the company protects you against the state. When and how it is useful in a democracy. But that's the balance that I would like to see, as opposed to one is good, the other is bad, or vice versa. I mean, sometimes we need, for example, companies to step up and say, look, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to protect your privacy more than anything else. Why? Well, maybe I have my commercial interest. Fine. I like that talk today. Tomorrow, I might like the state talk and say, dear government, can you please protect my privacy against that company because they changed their mind now and they want to have more of my data? So the interplay is not between one and the other, but it's a three sort of elements game. Shall we say, civil society, governments of all kinds and not multinational of all kinds, business. Let's make sure that the third doesn't pay the price for both, but actually put the two in some kind of balance.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you overall for the talk and the conversation. I think it has been illuminating even for me. And I hope the audience will realize why I feel very lucky whenever I get to hang out with you. I know we have still got many, many questions that we didn't get around to. So both of us are fairly active on the internet, which probably won't surprise you. We're both on Twitter, both on basically any other internet platform. So if you do have follow-up questions that you'd like to ask Luciano, then I would suggest you find us online and we can try and get any answers to you. And I know we're going to send a follow-up email, or OII Events is going to send a follow-up email. So there's a couple of resources we might be able to point to as well to answer some of these questions. So for now, thank you for listening and thank you to Luciano. And I don't know if you have any final words.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you, Luciano and Jess, for a fascinating insight today. Thank you, everyone, for attending. And as Jess mentioned, we will be sending out a follow-up email in due course. Our next webinar is next week on Wednesday with Dr. Maria Rosaria Tadeo. We'll be looking at the risks of trusting AI for national defense purposes. And that's on 3rd of June at 1 p.m. UK time. And you can visit the OII events page to sign up for that. Thank you again to everyone for being involved, and we wish you all a lovely evening. Thank you.